he mentions a number of different times that as a professional during the Depression, you couldn't get money. If a client paid you in a check, there was nowhere to go cash it. The banks wouldn't cash a check from an individual at all.
Wow.
And the one place he could get cash was from his cash value life insurance policies.
Wow.
During the Great Depression.
Welcome to Money Vision U. In this podcast, we are passionate about teaching the financial class you should have had in high school so you can learn how to fast track your financial freedom. If you want to learn how to make, manage, and multiply your money and see opportunities the way the wealthy do, then you came to the right place. I'm your host, Stuart Berryhill. Money Vision U, class in session. Welcome to another episode of Money Vision U. Today we have John Inslee on the podcast with us, who is leading a financial planning revolution to help you take back control of your money, your lifestyle, and your retirement plan. So that all sounds like great news to us and something that we want to achieve. So with that being said, John, welcome to the podcast.
Stuart, thanks so much for having me on. This will be fun.
Yes, sir. Always love talking about money. So to get started, just one thing you talk about is just after, kind of in your bio, after losing almost everything during the Great Recession, you just talk about you became obsessed with finding safe, predictable ways to save and create wealth to kind of protect from just different corruption and chaos that can be involved in the financial system. So can you talk more about that and just your financial background in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So my story, so to speak, goes back really to the late 90s. I got out of the Army and applied at a company and was in kind of the right place at the right time. They were a government contractor. They specialized in collecting defaulted student loans, of all things. And so I went to work there, and it turns out I was pretty good at that and got into a management position pretty quickly. And it was the late 90s, right? It's the build up to the tech bubble. And so there was going to be an IPO and we were all going to be wildly wealthy. And it was that era. And then, of course, the bubble burst. The IPO never happened. Still did well there. But, you know, it didn't turn out to be the ducks and bunnies that was originally thought it was going to be. So I left that company with an employee stock ownership plan that had some money in it. And did a little research and a little calculating and realized I was going to be exposed to some pretty serious taxes later on in life. And I wanted to do something different. I've always been kind of independent. I want to keep control of things myself. And so my next thing was a real estate venture. And we bought some property in Washington State and subdivided, and we're going to build spec homes. And of course, by this time we're in the early to mid 2000s. And the as if appraisals, if you remember that era, the real estate market was going crazy. Everything was going up, up, up. And so we were, again, this was going to be, you know, hitting it out of the park. And of course, by 2008, I'm about halfway through building the first spec home. And let me just say, too, that it wasn't just the economics. It certainly played a factor, but I also had no idea what I was doing. So I made some big mistakes, and that contributed to my demise, so to speak. But the 2008, when everything crashed in the real estate market, that really just wiped me out, basically. So the good thing is I'm grateful for that experience today, because it kind of was a wake-up call, and it got me to start reading, to start educating myself about investing and about money and economics and things that what I found was there's a lot of things I thought I knew that turned out not to be true. And in the course of all of these books and all the studying, I came across a webinar one night, and this advisor was talking about this couple, and they had their home equity, and he was kind of mapping this thing out. And he started talking about a whole life insurance policy that was building up cash value. And that was my first exposure at that point to this idea that life insurance could be something more than a death benefit. So somewhere in that presentation, he uttered the words infinite banking, and that led me to Nelson Nash's famous book, Becoming Your Own Banker, and then Bank on Yourself, and a number of others. And so I kind of went down this road. and wound up becoming very convinced that this was a wonderful strategy to approach, to build up cash value, to build up wealth in a life insurance policy that could be used for other things. And so I set up my own policies and got them working and just got very passionate about this whole concept. And I was kind of ready for a career change at that point. And I'd been to many, many financial advisors and nobody had ever told me anything about this. So I thought, well, nobody seems to be talking about it in the financial services world. Maybe that's what I should do since I'm so passionate about it. So that's what I did. I started my practice in 2012 to introduce this concept to people and help them get it set up and use it in their own lives.
So, okay. So a couple of things. First, that recession, I know, wiped a lot of people out. I was in high school then, so I was not in the real estate market game yet, and nor did I really know what was going on because you're a high schooler. So that wasn't really the current event that we were talking about necessarily, although it probably should have been because there probably could have been great lessons from that. But yeah, you got back on your feet and figured out different things. And so now it's all centered around this whole life insurance policy and using that to invest. Can you break that down a little bit for us? I know we've kind of talked about that on the podcast before, but this is a big concept that is one, and it goes back to two. Nobody talks about it. Like, you go to financial advisors, they don't talk about it. And you're saying this is such a, you know, unique opportunity and way of investing that a lot of people have used, I guess, the past century or however long the time frame is, and just no one talks about it. So anytime you hear something new like that, it just takes a few times to hear it to really get a good grasp on it. So just really dive into the weeds there on what that means. You threw out terms of infinite banking, whole life insurance, cash value, things like that. Define some of those for us.
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons this doesn't get talked about is it just comes across as so complicated. And there's all these financial service-y terms. So happy to jump into that. I think one of the things I like to try to do is really simplify it. So if you could really simplify it, all this is a system for saving, borrowing, and investing, right? This is what we all do every day, whether we're actively investing or whatever we're doing. We all use banks to save, borrow, or invest, right? If you have a brokerage account, that's just a bank. And so we call that the banking equation, right? You're saving, borrowing, and investing using the conventional banking system. And so where these terms come from, like infinite banking or bank on yourself or cash flow banking, it's marketers have called this concept a thousand different things. But as you mentioned, life insurance, whole life insurance has been around for close to 200 years. It's nothing new. The marketers have come up with new things to call it repeatedly. And so those are marketing terms, right? And what they're referencing is this banking function that we can use the unique features of a whole life insurance contract to save and borrow and invest. And it's sort of outside the conventional system and has some features that make it unique. So features, for instance, like guarantees. When we put money into a whole life contract, it's going to grow by a larger amount every single year for the rest of my life. And there's nothing I can do about it. It's just how it works, right? It's going to go up by a larger amount. So it just grows. It only goes up. It doesn't go down. It just grows. And so that's a unique compared to other things. The other unique thing is that, see, life insurance companies are very different than banks. Banks are in the business of taking in deposits and then leveraging those deposits to make loans to people. So banks take risks, right? They take a dollar, they loan out 10 to potentially risky borrowers.
That's how they make money. Yeah.
That's how they make money, right? Insurance companies are in the business of mitigating risk. We use insurance companies to offset the risks we either don't want to take or can't afford to take, right? We carry auto insurance because we don't want to take on the risk of having to pay for the liability of someone else's injuries, property damage, wherever. So we pay an insurance company to take that risk. Okay. So we do the same thing in the life insurance world, and we can use a properly designed cash value life insurance policy to shift the risk, so to speak. We can shift market risk to the insurance company because they're on the hook to meet their promises to you, their contractual promises. So that market risk is their problem. right? In some ways. So this is really what we're doing, is just shifting risk. And so we can build up these cash values. So an insurance company is highly regulated. They can only invest in certain things. The regulators at the state level dictate really what they can invest in so that they can meet their future obligations. So they're two very, very different models. So an insurance company, for instance, can't go out and buy any kind of crypto or Bitcoin or whatever, just off the fly. Just can't do that. The regulators would have a cow. And so they're in things like highly rated mortgages and bonds and corporate bonds and things like that. And also on a very long time horizon. Okay. So one of the investments that an insurance company can make that the regulators like a lot is that they can make loans to their own policy owners. So what that means is there's a very unique system with a whole life contract where you can use that policy as collateral to make loans from the insurance company. So the insurance company says, okay, you have a whole life policy. You have X amount of cash value and X amount of death benefit in that policy. What's sort of happening is they're saying the limit of what we can loan you is the amount of cash value you have in that policy. The death benefit is the collateral in that policy. So the insurance company knows if you never pay the loan back, eventually you're going to die and the death benefit's going to be payable, and they're going to offset the loan and interest from that death benefit before it goes to your beneficiary. So the unique situation this creates for us as the borrower is we're in 100% complete control of the terms on this loan. So we can pay it back over any amount of time. We can start payments, we can stop payments, we can change the payment. We technically could not pay it back at all. That's also our prerogative. Not recommended. I always recommend pay our loans back. We want to be quote unquote an honest banker,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, you kind of steal from yourself if you don't pay your loans back, and that doesn't.
Would it affect your credit score if you weren't, or is that something that would show up on that?
No, it does not. So there's no credit reporting. There's no tax reporting. Mm-hmm. None of that on your whole life policy. So there's also no application. So there's no qualifying. The only qualification is, do you have a policy that has cash value in it? That's really it. So we fill out a form, we check a box, we send it to the insurance company. And about 7 days later, 3 to 7 days later, the direct deposit shows up in our account. That's the process. Very simple, very straightforward. We control the repayment. I covered that. The other thing is the only thing that's collateralized is the policy. So if I'm borrowing from my policy to buy a vehicle, for instance, I own the title to that vehicle. I essentially paid cash for it, even though I financed it through the policy.
Right.
Okay. So there's no property that's encumbered. I hold the title to whatever property I happen to buy with a policy loan. The policy itself is collateralized by the insurance company. As far as the death benefit goes, I control the repayment schedule. I don't have to qualify. It's very simple, right? So there's the very unique features with these loans that make them an attractive place to use, especially when we start talking about investing. Now, there's one more feature that's probably super important, and that is the because of the way this is structured, right? So we're not borrowing the money directly from our own policy. The money's being borrowed from the insurance company's general investment fund. Right. And so some companies, because of that structure, some companies will not recognize that the loan is against the policy, and they'll credit the guaranteed growth and the non-guaranteed dividends every year as if that money we borrowed was still there, because technically it is. Right. So those are called non-direct recognition loans, and that's something we're always looking for on these types of policies. So we have all of these unique features, plus the capital we put in there is going to grow as if we didn't borrow it out. So we don't give up anything to use the money short term. We don't give anything up long term. So okay. I can give you an example, right? So I mentioned that this real estate project I had all went kind of imploded during the 2008 crisis. One of the things that a light bulb went on for me is I realized that had I taken my capital out of that ESOP and put it into a properly designed whole life policy before I started that project, even if number one, it probably would have changed the direction of the project for other reasons. But the main thing though is, let's say the whole thing blew up anyway. At the end of the day, I could have paid that loan back and effectively preserved that capital. As it was just a total loss. Capital's gone. Mm-hmm. And I ran it through the policy, even if it took me 10 more years to pay it back to my policy, I would have gained all the growth on that capital going all the way back to the beginning. And so I could have been my own bailout plan, where I was watching the banks get bailed out, but I could have bailed myself out because nobody was bailing out property owners back then. So that was a light bulb that went on for me, is I could have preserved that capital for my entire life instead of it all just going up in smoke.
Yeah. It didn't have a deadline basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you wouldn't have had to foreclose and just lose all your money. You would have, you know, still been able to hold on to the real estate, and, you know, it may not have been as lucrative, but, you know, obviously from 2008 to now, I'm sure it's doubled, tripled, quadrupled in value or whatever it is. So it would have eventually kind of made money one way or another, and you just wouldn't have completely lost everything and could have paid back that loan from the life insurance policy, is kind of what you're saying.
Yes. And I think what we have to think about is every dollar that passes through your hands has a future value, right? If you invested it or if you parked it somewhere, it's worth X amount. And when you think about that over a lifetime, if you're in your 20s, you could be talking about another 70 or 80 years or more, depending on what technology does. And then, in the next decades or so. And the compounding, even at very modest rates over timeframes like that, can build up to just enormous amounts. And so you have to think about every dollar has a future value. So how can you preserve as many of those future value dollars as possible is essentially what we're able to do with these policies.
Okay. So I want to go back to a couple questions just that I have over things you said, and just want some clarity on them. So for one, you just talked about, so this is a life insurance policy. So the primary, so I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a term life insurance option policy, and then you have this whole life insurance policy option. And so we're not going to get into the differences on those, but there's a whole life insurance policy. But the main benefit of those is to protect your family, basically, if there's a death, and, you know, it's insurance. And so you want to make sure that they have, you know, security for the future if something happened to you and you were providing the money and things like that. So when you start with the whole life insurance policy, what is the baseline? Are you having to invest yearly into this, or, you know, how does that work? I don't have much money, if I was doing a term insurance, life insurance plan, it may be, you know, $25, $50 a month, something like that. Where's the kind of the starting line for a whole life insurance plan, to where it's going to, one, protect your family in the tragic case of a death? And then when can you actually start using that money to, I guess, loan to yourself?
Right. So there's really no minimum amount. You could put any amount almost into a whole life contract. But what I tell folks when I meet with them is somewhere around that $500 a month range is really where we want to start. That's when it's going to accumulate some meaningful level of cash value accumulation in those early years. We could do less than that, but you might be 5 years down the road before it's a usable, meaningful amount. But at 500, that's $6,000 a year. Somewhere around 80% of that is going to be available as cash value in the first year, starting the first year, and it'll build up from there. Like I said, it'll go up by a larger amount every year. So I think the most common way for people to get started is that monthly savings scenario, where they're putting money in the policy month after month, and it builds up.
Okay.
And that $500 level is, to me, kind of where it becomes meaningful.
But so $500, that's a good amount of money. That's a good chunk of change. And so what I would ask with that is, you know, especially, you know, a lot of my podcasts are younger, you know, especially, and I think it's great to look at something like this in the 20s, because the sooner you can do it, just what Warren Buffett compound interest is like the eighth wonder of the world, whatever it is. And so that's what you're getting to utilize. And so, you know, someone starting in their 20s, you know, $500 a month can be a lot, but, you know, it almost seems like a retirement plan type of thing. So, you know, I don't know if it's like a hard recommendation one way or another, but if you're doing this, is there a reason to do something like a 401k or an IRA, or, you know, is it kind of be all in one area? What's the take there?
So, in my opinion, probably not, if you have to pick between one or the other. And the reason for that is accessibility. I think if funds are limited and you really have to pick where you build it up, you've got to put it somewhere where you can get your hands on it if you need it, whether mm-hmm. that's for an investment opportunity or for an emergency. I think the statistic is that 40-some% of the American population or families couldn't afford a $400 expense without borrowing money to cover it. And I see this in my practice all the time. I meet with people and they have, a younger person with $50,000 in a 401k because employer matches and whatever.
Right.
But literally nothing in a savings or a checking or anywhere they could
actually nothing get liquid. Cash. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing liquid. And I think that's the real advantage to using this whole life product is you're still putting the money away towards a retirement. And retirement, I really don't like that word. It conjures up images of rocking chairs on the front porch. And most people I talk to, that's not what we're just talking about passive income. That's what retirement is, right? It's that point where you have enough passive income that you don't have to go to a job every day to put food on the table. And so that's all that is. So it's this thing that we can build up cash accumulation. We can accumulate an asset in a place that's going to build lifelong, right? Whole life covers you for your whole life, your entire life. So it's a lifelong endeavor, but we have access to it. So that if the transmission blows up in the car, you've got some place that you could put your hands on that $500 or $800 or $1,000 and get it fixed without putting it on a credit card. So it gives us accessibility for emergency funds. And then as it builds up for investments, we can use it that way. And then eventually down the road, we can turn it into a passive income. The policy itself converts to a passive income stream when we decide that we want to do that.
Okay. One question I had with it. So, I got a lot of questions, but the one thing, so once you put it in, all right, so you're building it up, you're starting with a baseline of zero. And you're compared to if you buy a term policy and you, this is morbid, but if you die the next day, you've got, I don't know, 50, 100,000, whatever amount of coverage right there, whole life. Mm-hmm. You start investing in it. I guess you use the word investing in it that next day. And say you've only put $500 in and you die, month one after starting, you would only have $500 of coverage, I guess, would be the word to give to your family, or is there a higher, at least minimum, that would be given to a family in the event of a death?
Yeah, correct. So the thing with life insurance, particularly whole life insurance, is there's a lot of leverage for the death benefit. So that $500 a month policy, every individual based on their age and health and gender and so forth is going to be a little different. So I'm going to generalize right now, but that $500 a month policy, that $6,000 a year that's going into the policy, based on how the policy is structured, it's going to have some base, it's going to have some term insurance built in there as a rider, but most of the money is going to go into what's called a paid up additions rider. I won't get lost in the weeds with the structure, but so the death benefit on that $6,000 a year policy might be $250,000.
Oh, wow.
Based on how that's all structured, right? So in your example, you paid $500 the first month, and you that afternoon walked out in front of a bus and, God forbid, right? but your family's going to get $250,000 for your $500 payment.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. So that's enormous leverage. In the early years of a whole life policy, it's an enormous amount of leverage between the premium paid and the death benefit. As the policy gets older, 30 years, 25, 30, 40 years down the road, the cash value in the policy and the death benefit begin to close the gap. Mm-hmm. The cash value will build up to be closer to the death benefit. But if it's designed right, your death benefit's always going to be more than the cash value and multiples more than the premium you paid.
And so if somebody, say someone died, okay, let's say you've invested, you've got $250,000 of cash value in the policy and, your death benefit, that seems like an oxymoron, but your death benefit is $350,000. You die, your family gets $350,000. What happens to that $250,000? Do they also get at, or does that continue with the family in the sense that they can still use it for, I don't know, whatever investment?
So here's a common misconception with how this works. So glad you brought this up. So every dollar you put in the policy buys death benefit. It's life insurance, right? You're buying a death benefit. Those structured pieces that I mentioned, the type of death benefit you buy, so either base term or paid up additions, determines kind of how much cash value is produced in that policy. And so the death benefit, we look at it in two columns. If we were to look at an illustration, there's a death benefit column and a cash value column, but it's not really two things. It's really one thing. The death benefit is throws off this byproduct of cash value from the actuarial calculations and the dividends that come in and some of those technical things. So it's really one thing. And if again, if it's designed right, the death benefit is always going to be greater than the cash value. So the way to think about this is that there's not two separate things. And this is a common thing that I'm giving up the cash value in order to get the death benefit. It's all one thing. The death benefit you have, or the cash value you have access to while you're alive. Okay. The death benefit is that thing that's going to pass to your family when you die. Okay. But they're really integrated into one thing. So you're not giving up one to get the other. They're both part of each other. So that cash value while you're still alive is what you have access to borrow, to invest, to do what you're going to do with it. The death benefit, the way I look at death benefit personally is it's backing up all the investment activity I do with the policy. So, in that example of the real estate thing that blew up on me, had I had the policy in place, that's another benefit. If I walked out in front of a bus halfway through that project with this half built house, the death benefit actually would have worked out better for my family had that happened, right? Yeah. Because the death benefit was significantly more than the cash value at that point, or would have been. And so they would have received. So the way I look at a death benefit is it's really backstopping all the activity I do with the cash value. If something happens to me halfway through that investment activity or whatever the case may be, that death benefit is going to come in income tax free, by the way, in most cases. It's going to come into my family and they can either finish those investments or liquidate them or whatever they want to do with them. They'll have the cash to deal with it. So it really, what it's going to do is flood my family with the same amount of capital or more than I would have done had I completed the investment if I hadn't died.
Okay. Yeah. So
that's the way I look at it. It's a backstop.
Okay. It kind of reminds me of have you seen It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah,
surely. It's like one of the greatest movies of all time, for sure. The best Christmas movie. I mean, Jimmy Stewart, I forgot his name in the movie, but he goes to Mr. Potter and, he's needing money and he's like, here's all I got. And Mr. Potter's like, you got anything else? You got a life insurance policy. And he gives it to him and he's like, well, you're better off dead than alive. And so and it kind of reminds me of that concept of like, I don't know, yet debt or whatever it was, and just death at that point. Obviously, not everything is a money value. Life cannot have a money value, but that's how Mr. Potter was looking at it. Crooked old man, but it reminds me of that. And so I don't know if it's the same thing, but I don't know if you ever paid attention to that, but maybe those things kind of go hand, or that's kind of what it's talking about, which is kind of unique. That movie's from the 30s or 40s or whatever it is.
It is. That movie takes place during the Great Depression, and I love it for a couple of reasons as a financial advisor. One is it points very clearly the bank run scenario and exactly what happens when things go wrong with an economy. The bank doesn't have any money. They can't give you any money. The other thing is there's a book. Talk about a book that every high school student should have to read. It's a book called The Great Depression, A Diary by Benjamin Roth. And Benjamin Roth was an attorney in Youngstown, Ohio throughout the Great Depression, a young attorney. And he kept very detailed diaries all the way up until like 1954 or something like that. And it's a fascinating read. And I just stumbled across the book. It wasn't recommended to me or anything. I just stumbled across it. And then I was just thrilled when I started reading it. He mentions a number of different times that as a professional during the Depression, you couldn't get money. If a client paid you in a check, there was nowhere to go cash it. The banks wouldn't cash a check from an individual at all.
Wow.
And the one place he could get cash was from his cash value life insurance policies.
Wow.
During the Great Depression, right? And that really struck home. And he made the comment that a lot of professionals made it through the Depression basically from their cash value life insurance policies, where they could still get money. A bank would cash a life insurance company check, but not a personal check.
So these insurance companies, they have cash available somehow, some way. They just storing it up then if they're going to be the only ones with cash and the banks don't have it.
Well, and this is why I talk about the difference between the models. The banking model is based on taking risk. The insurance model is based on mitigating risk. And if you look at the crises in our history, you know, I mentioned non-guaranteed dividends. An insurance company pays dividends back to policy owners when the company performs better than expected. Right? They make a projection. If they beat it, then they pay these dividends. And in a mutual company, they pay those to us, the policy owner, because we're sort of like partial owners. And so if you think about that, the company that I have my personal policy with has paid a dividend out to their policy owners every single year for 118 years.
Pretty good. Okay.
So when you think about that, they go through the Great Depression, World War One, World War Two,
yeah, crazy.
All of these crises, and not only did they survive these crises as a company, but they performed better than expected and paid policy owners dividends during those crises. Right? It's just a totally different model, and I think a lot of people don't understand it. They don't really get how solid that model is.
Yeah, I'm just learning more and more about it. I think it's so interesting too. One, that it's been around over 100 years, and this is what people did. I mean, Roth IRA wasn't there, 401k wasn't there. This is what people did. And then, you know, the Roth and 401k model took over for whatever reason, but really this is, and you use the terminology bank on yourself. This is what that is. I mean, you're not necessarily relying on it. You got mitigated risk. And so I guess that's, you mentioned it always grows. And so I guess that's from the dividends is what you're talking about. It's always growing every year, whatever kind of cash value amount that you have. And so you slowly build it up. You got $25,000. It's not, you know, year 2023, year 2024, it's going to be more than $25,000, even if you don't invest it at all. You didn't add anything to it. It's going to probably not much, but you know, a couple percentage points.
Well, the longer it goes, the better it gets, right? It grows. It not only goes up every year, it goes up by a larger amount every year. And so we literally get this compounding effect. So, and it's not just the dividends, by the way, it's actually the actuarial built-in growth in the policy is the guaranteed part, right? It's guaranteed to grow by a certain amount. The dividends are on top of that. And actually, if you get 20 years down the road, that guaranteed piece of growth is much larger than usually than the dividend.
Okay.
In the early years, it may not be, but later on, it builds momentum. It builds on itself and continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
So, yeah, I mean, the more I hear, it's just like, why, you know, it's going to be so hard for people to get away, because the norm is 401k Roth IRA. That's just the norm. And it's going to be so hard for someone to move from that mindset to being all in on an actual cash value policy, because you're investing in it. What you have, you know, to invest is the same as like an IRA. You got to invest in that every year to be able to, you know, have more that's, you know, compounding, or, you know, you can self-direct those and invest those accordingly. And same with the cash value thing, but you're more banking on yourself, super safe. That the statistic of it's paid dividends every year for the last 118 years, that's wild. Like, I hope people can realize how wild that is. We're talking about 2008, you know, the recession. You have the 70s had their thing going on where interest rates, I don't know what it was, 12%, 15%, inflation, things like that. Inflation after we took the dollar off the gold standard. Then the Great Depression, world wars, things like that. I mean, that's wild that it's paid. People could not go to banks to get cash. They had to go to their life insurance policies. That's wild.
The Great Depression.
And I hope that I can just hammer home that point for some people. Like, this is something to heavily think about.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Money Vision U. If this is something that added value to you, then please subscribe, leave a review, and share. We are passionate about teaching financial literacy so you can learn to take control of your financial future. If you want to learn more, then follow us on social media platforms @MoneyVisionU. We look forward to catching you in the next class.